Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu. Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's the relationship between the strong emotions of a challenging personal life and the ability of an actor to embody characters who seem entirely real to audiences? After having appeared in more than 36 films, including All the President's Men, Wall Street, and The Firm, Hal Holbrook was nominated in 2007 for an Academy Award for his performance in Into the Wild. This past summer, he starred in the film Water for Elephants. But Holbrook is perhaps best known for his five-decade run of one-man shows portraying Mark Twain. As he explains in his new memoir, Harold, the Boy Who Became Mark Twain, the role evolved out of a college project developed with his first wife, and playing Twain helped him develop both a deep appreciation for the talents of the great American novelist and also an understanding of his own life, which was marked by early loss and abuse, but also by a great appreciation for the small kindnesses shown to him by people who cared. Hal, welcome to Think.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Chris.
You open the book trying to remember being held by your mother, and you can't even remember if what you think you recall is real.
No, I can't. It was like, as I said, it's like a dream or something. You know, it's a very faint kind of memory. This little, I just remember being a little child, very young, walking around, stumbling around, and it was on the porch of our house, in big house in Cleveland. And they had this green wicker furniture, you know, that has the little stub ends that hurt you. And I remember bumping into them and crying. And I remember this young woman reaching out for me. And my grandmother reached out first and got me. And that was all I remember. I think the young woman was my mother. I never got into her arms, as I said then, you know.
You were not encouraged to ask any questions at all about why your parents were gone from your life by the time you were two.
My people didn't talk. My people remained silent about too many things. They would always say, well, when you get older, we'll tell you. And then when you got older, they didn't remember or something. They were very... what's the word? Closed in, you know. I mean, the whole idea of show business must have been frightening to my folks from that brought me up in New England and all, because my mother ran away, left us when I was two and my sisters were 1 and 3. I mean, the poor woman had had, by the time she was 24, she'd had 3 children. And she just left. And I didn't know until I was 12 years old that she'd gone into show business. She left and went to New York, became a chorus girl. Because nobody in my family would say that, would talk about that. That was not nice.
You found this old trunk of hers and discovered her.
Yeah,
some of
I found
things.
A trunk of hers in the basement. My grandfather had built this big house in Cleveland. It had about 20 rooms in it. And it had a big rec room in the basement with a shiny wooden floor, long, probably 20 feet long. And my sisters and I would go down there, and there was an old Victrola down there with one of those horns on the top, you know, his master's voice. We found these records, My Blue Heaven, you know, stuff like that. Found out they belonged to our mother. We used to get out and listen, and there was a door that was always locked. One day it was open. Why, I don't know. I have no idea why it was open. But I went in. It was a trunk room. And there was this trunk, you know, the kind that, like you hang clothes on one side, you know, the old-fashioned trunk, tall
sure,
trunk.
Yeah.
And there was some drawers, and I opened. I found baby shoes, and I found little silver cups, and I found these long, you know, where you unroll by pulling sideways, you unroll a whole picture, and mm-hmm. all these chorus girl people bent over and smiling, and there was a little arrow under one, and I thought, I wonder who that is. And then I saw some letters, and they were letters to my mother from somebody who was not my father. I thought, my gosh, this is my mother. And she was in show business. Holy mackerel, you know, oh, wow, you know, gee, I mean, this is wild. But then I felt like I was intruding on something private. So I started to read one of the letters and put it back. I never read them. And I always had a feeling that my mother had made a decision when she was just a little, you know, a young woman to leave and go. And it must have been a very powerful decision for her. And I didn't want to intrude, frankly. I just never wanted to intrude.
So is that why you never looked for her?
Huh?
Is that why you never looked for her?
Yes, that's why I never looked for her. My little sister, Alberta, who died very young, tragically, she really wanted to find her mother. And the weird, really weird thing is she tried through the police in California, because we knew she disappeared in California.
Mm-hmm.
She tried to find my sister, my mother, through the police. And she tracked my mother to Carmel, California in 1948, I think it is, to a driver's license. And the really weird thing is that my older sister, June, was waiting tables in Carmel, California that same year.
They could have passed each other on the street.
Yes.
Hmm.
And, you know, we kids, my sister June went out there and married somebody. You know, we used to, you know, you used to kind of think, maybe my mother will be on the street somewhere here and she'll walk up and say, hi, I'm your mother. You know, I mean, yeah, you kind of had this in the back of your mind and like a little fantasy, you know. And years later, I had an opportunity to find my mother. And I didn't follow it up. And I'm sorry I didn't now. Especially since Thomas Labine, my editor at Farrar Straus that published this book, when he read the book, before we started chopping it down to 400 pages, he said, you have to find the themes in the book, Cal. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, well, the theme is survival. He said, yes, but there are two other themes. And I said, well, what are they? He said, one is fear of insanity. I said, well, yeah, I can remember that because we visited my father in the insane asylum all the time when we were kids, so you could get pretty nervous about that. Mm-hmm. You know, they got two great big doors, you know, prison bars, you know, they would unlock. And in those days, it's hard for people today to understand, but in those days, back in the 30s, I mean, you know, a lot of people thought insanity was maybe you could catch it.
Yeah.
Heredity, you know. And I said, what's the other one? He says, your mother. I said, my mother? I don't think of my mother. He said, Hal, where do you think you got your talent? Where do you think you got this impish, this suicide impulse from those sober-sided people in New England? Are you kidding? This is your mother. So I'm very sorry that I, you know, I just didn't want to bother her, you know. Which is interesting when, you know, when you write a book about yourself, it's a voyage of discovery. It really is. And when I just said that then, it reminded me that I had to figure, why didn't I want to bother her? She was my mother. And then the next thing that comes into my mind is I was a loner. I was always alone. And I was a loner. And I never joined up with people. And, you know, that ruled a great deal of my life. It's very strange that I should end up doing a solo on stage with Twain. I mean, that is kind of weird when you stop to think of it. I never put that down, but it's pretty obvious. But I was a loner. And I had a chance. I was when I made a big success, the book Harold goes up to where I became successful mm-hmm. with Twain in 1959 in New York. And I stopped there. I don't mention any of my later achievements or awards or anything, you know, because it's just that story, period. I'm working on the other one now. I'm 550 pages in. It's going to be longer than a Tolstoy novel, I'm afraid. It's frightening. I'm only at page 90. I'm only in 1988, and, you know. But when I, in 1959, when I made the success in New York, and then I went on the road, and I played San Francisco, and I played Los Angeles, and my agent from, I finally had an agent, William Morris Agency. I never even had an agent, you know, and Harry Kalsheim came out there to show me up, show me around. He took me to 20th Century Fox to meet some big mogul. I can't remember his name. You know, you walk in the room and there's about 3 acres before you get to his desk and a little chair in front of, out in the middle of the room. So I was sitting there and the conversation didn't go very well because you could see that he was looking at me. I was 34 years old and mm-hmm. thinking, this kid is playing Mark Twain. Is somebody kidding? You know, he wasn't taking it serious. So just to make conversation, I said, my mother disappeared out here. Mm-hmm. He looked at me kind of funny and then asked a few things, and he became more human. He said, when did she disappear? I said, I don't know. I don't know. What was her name? I said, her name was Aileen Davenport. He pushed a button under his desk right out of a movie, and a door on the right side opened, and a man came in, and he was introduced as Joseph Schenck, Joe Schenck. One of the hierarchy of Hollywood, one of the people who started Hollywood, Joe Schenck. He sat down. He asked me about my mother. I said, she was on tour. He said, with what? I said, George White's Scandals. He said, what year was that? I said, I think it was 1931. He said, my sister Patsy took care of the girls on that tour. Would you like me to ask her about your mother, Aileen? I said, well, yeah. But you know, I never looked them up. I never followed it up, except when I went back home, I went to the letters I had saved for my mother. And 3 of them had the return address, Schenck, in that address in Brooklyn where Patsy Schenck lived. She was staying with Patsy. And I could have found out about her. And once again, I didn't want to intrude. I just chose to go into the woods alone, you know?
Actor Hal Holbrook is my guest. His new memoir is called Harold, The Boy Who Became Mark Twain.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Academy Award-nominated actor Hal Holbrook. His new memoir is called Harold, The Boy Who Became Mark Twain. I want to ask you one last thing, and I don't want to dwell on this too much, but with regard to your mother, does it make it easier to forgive her if you'd never met her and you can imagine that from a distance she cared about you and she loved you?
I don't know. One would think so. And certainly when I began to become well-known, you know, right on the top of my mind once in a while was that I wonder if my mother must know that I'm an actor and that I'm getting well-known. She knows who I am if she's alive. And at that time, she certainly should have been alive. I was only 35, 36 years old. So how old was she? She probably less than 60. Mm-hmm. She had to be out there knowing. That's another reason, Chris, I never looked her up. Because she could have found me. I mean, let's face it. She could have contacted me and said, Harold, you know. But she didn't, and for that reason, you know, I get very, it's odd talking now about my mother. I get very emotional. And I never did. But uncovering all this stuff is like a discovery that you didn't mean to make. So it gets to be very strangely emotional. But she must have known. I'm sure she knew who I was. So at least she knew that her son was, did a good job.
So yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the development of the Mark Twain character, because you had this wonderful mentor when you were in college.
Yeah, Ed Wright.
Yeah, and he was the first one to suggest that you and your first wife, Ruby, put this sketch together. And initially you thought, oh, I don't like this material. I don't care about this. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, it's interesting because we came down here to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're
I have
the
played
school circuit, right?
I have played about 200 towns in Texas. Mm-hmm. I mean, all the way from Alpine and Marfa to Alice to Pampa to McKinney. I played them all.
That's an education too.
And Ed, our head of the theater department at Denison University, he came up with this idea. He talked to Harry Bird Klein here in Dallas, mm-hmm. who ran the Southern School Assemblies. And Harry Bird said, you have any kids at that school, Ed, that can do drama? I need a drama act. And Ed said, oh, yes, I have this young couple going to be the next London Fontaine. And Harry didn't know who that was, but said, well, what kind of show they have? What kind of, you know, pretty much, you know, anything you'd want. Well, it has to be about 50 minutes, and it has to be educational. Oh, it is. Yeah, they do some Shakespeare. And he made it all up on the road. I mean, made it up all on the sidewalk with Harry. And then he came back, and he called us up beginning the senior year and said, explain the buddy, you know. And they had a offer for $210 a week and $15 a week for gas and oil for 30 weeks. Schools in Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Arkansas, New Mexico. And, you know, I mean, to get paid for acting, wow. So we developed the show during my senior year, and we took it on the road. And we traveled over 30,000 miles in a station wagon, and we traveled all the way through this part of the country, and we were marooned in a flood in Alice. Couldn't get out for a couple of days. Lost a few days. Went back and picked them up. We had 2 and 3 shows a day in different towns. We had to travel at 80 miles an hour to make the dates. On 2-lane roads, there was no interstates then. The interstates were not built then.
2-lane highways.
You know, like the interstate, you know, big
right, but
big
so
highway.
You were on 2-lane highways.
They were just 2-lane highways.
Yeah.
You had to learn how to pass a truck a trailer truck or a farm truck, you know, and judge it so you didn't get hit by the guy coming at you from the opposite direction. And we traveled on icy roads. I mean, a girl quartet that was on the circuit with us got killed in New Mexico by a butane truck, and it was a tough life. But we learned a lot. Mainly we learned to survive in front of audiences, because we had to play audiences. Most of the schools, they weren't high schools. Mm-hmm. They were district schools. And they had kids from the first grade to the 12th. Now, you want to go out there with As You Like It in green tights in front of an audience, you know, in Alpine or wherever, and in green tights? With the football team down front, I mean, man, you had to learn to survive. And we learned to survive on the stage. We learned to survive. And then the Mark Twain number we did, which was a burlesque of what you and I are doing, an interview, It became our Get Off With Your Life number. We did it at the end of the show. People liked it.
When you first started doing Twain alone, the first time you stepped on onto stage with nobody else there, you liken it to the first time that a clown is shot out of a circus cannon.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that? Is it, even as an experienced actor, it's terrifying to be out there by yourself, or was?
It was frightening, Chris. It was utterly frightening, especially since I had never been able to get up and speak in public. I used to be afraid to do what I'm doing now. Mm-hmm. I would go on the Johnny Carson show when I got, well, no, I would try to think in advance what I was going to say. And I would be frightened. And to get up and speak in front of an audience, I got all lost. I forgot what I was going to say and made a fool of myself. Until one day, I don't remember when, but why, but I just realized that what you do is say the first thing that comes into your head and just keep talking. That's all you do. That's what I'm doing now. And when I went out there the first time, I was frightened, but I had inured myself with the knowledge that I had to do it to earn a living. I had a little baby. We had just moved to New York. My first wife, Ruby, couldn't do the show anymore and didn't want to. I tried somebody else for most of a year, and it worked, but it wasn't the same thing. And also, it was chancy, you know, working with an attractive young woman on the road for weeks and weeks. Frankly, you know, I mean, let's face it, it's bad. It's bad for a marriage. It's just it's too tempting, you know. And the whole idea just didn't work. Also, you know, audiences loved Ruby and me because we were married.
Mm-hmm. There's something about that chemistry.
Yeah, they just loved the women's clubs. When we started playing, after the first year, we moved into colleges and clubs. And we became quite well successful in that little circuit, you know. So I went to see James B. Pond, who was the son of Mark Twain's lecture manager. Mm-hmm. And he was a gruff, grumpy kind of man. He'd been a great concert manager himself. Ruth Draper is one of the people that he discovered. Used to book Admiral Byrd, you know, that just went to the Antarctic. And he ran a magazine that was very forceful in the business. So I went to see him one day, and I asked him if he thought I could get the show booked with somebody else besides Ruby. He was a blunt guy. He didn't fool around. He didn't answer me. He said, why don't you do a solo of Twain? And he'd known Twain as a young boy.
Mm-hmm.
I said, a solo? Out on stage all by myself? Gee, Bim, I don't know. And he said, I think you could get booked. Period. That's it. That's all he said. He didn't answer my question about two people, nothing. So I walked out of there, and I had thought about it because Emlyn Williams had come to New York the year before and done Dickens. So I had to earn a living. I had to get a booking in a high school in Long Island for $35. I had to get money. I didn't have any family. We had nobody to back us up. Nothing. We went to New York with $200 in the bank, and I had to earn a living. So I had to go out there and I had to develop a show and walk out on stage as that old man and pray. And the amazing thing is, the first time I did it was in Lock Haven, Pennsylvania. And the first line, I figured I might get a little chuckle on. I got two laughs. I didn't even know what they were laughing at. And the audience kept laughing. Sometimes I didn't know that it was funny. And I thought, after 25 minutes, I'm thinking, holy mackerel, this is kind of fun. It's nice to make people laugh. Wonderful, you know. And so that launched me.
You talk about Twain being someone who is constantly searching for truth.
Good for you. I'm glad to hear you say that. That's what he was. I believe he was. You think about he's an example for us to follow. And I have been very strongly influenced by him. He's an example for us to follow today, seeking the truth, because we don't hear the truth anymore.
Why not?
Because people lie to support their own position. They don't even know they're lying. Look at the people running for president. I mean, really, it is disgusting. And I'm sure most people feel tired listening because they twist the truth. They change the facts to suit themselves and to support their own position. And this is not going to get this country anywhere. It's going to defeat us. It is defeating us. It's terribly important. I'm sorry, I went off on a side issue there. But the reason I do it is because that is very central to what drives me on the stage is Mark Twain. This man went out to find the truth. Do you think about this little boy with a big head? He had one of those big heads, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So did my daughter Victoria, and I realized she had so many brains in there. And he was a boy in a little dusty town on the edge of the Mississippi River. On the edge of the pioneer time of the West. Beyond that, it was like you didn't fool around out there with the Indians and all. You know, he moved there like he was born in 1835. On the Mississippi, a big river, a big waterway, a big highway. Exciting, you know, boats going by. Gosh, well, all those people on board with clothing and everything, and you know. And he eventually ended up going down the river and learning to pilot a steamboat. He was going to go to Brazil, to the gold mines. And he got fascinated with the piloting on the way down to New Orleans. He decided to, when the pilot said he would teach him, that he would forget the gold mines and, you know. And then the war came. He tried to be a soldier for a while, and he said he didn't like killing people he'd never been introduced to. And he was from a slave state, mm-hmm. too. This is very significant. Missouri was a slave state. There were slaves in Hannibal. I forget whether his father owned one or not, but he played with slave children. I mean, young little boys, white boys and black children in those days played together. My mother-in-law from Tennessee, Dixie's mother, would tell me about her family had a plantation. They would play together till about 12. And then the little boy would be told, the white boy would be said, he couldn't play with the little boy, black boy anymore. And the little black boy would be told that he had to call his friend, sir. And my mother-in-law, my dear, dear mother-in-law, tells this wonderful story about how this little boy, black slave, who loved her grandfather, refused to call him sir. He just refused. So, I mean, these are little human stories that you hear in the middle of all the theological stuff or ideological stuff that are human.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you look for in life, is the human side. You can't really solve interpersonal relationships without getting into the human side. You can't just be theoretical all the time, stand by one position all the time. Not in America. You can't go from Montana to Alabama to New York to Arizona and find the same point of view. And that's what I discovered traveling around this country. And the interesting thing about Mark Twain, he started out in a slave little community. He saw slaves being sold into slavery down in New Orleans and along the river. He saw black men with sweat glistening on their arms throwing 500-pound bales of cotton on board his steamboat. He watched. He went to San Francisco. He saw the way the Chinese were treated. Terrible. He came back east after he'd a story about a jumping frog made him well known. He came back east. He got wrote a book, went to the Holy Land, wrote a funny book about pilgrims of the Holy Land called The Innocents Abroad. He became the most successful author all of a sudden in the U.S. He's a big time. But he didn't stop there. He married the daughter of the leading abolitionist upstate New York in Elmira, Jervis Langdon. He married the daughter of a man who helped a black man in the Baltimore shipyards escape to the north through the Underground Railroad, whose name was Frederick Douglass, who became the leader of the black people.
My guest this hour is actor Hal Holbrook. His new memoir is called Harold, The Boy Who Became Mark Twain. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Academy Award nominated actor Hal Holbrook. His new memoir is called Harold, The Boy Who Became Mark Twain. I want to ask you this. Very few people would assume that New England military academies breed a lot of passionate actors. But you found when you were in military school as a young man, there was a sort of a cadre of young men who found comfort in this ability to express yourself.
Yeah, I was at Culver Military Academy mm-hmm. in Indiana. And I mean, one of the people was Oliver Ray, who became a co-producer with, in New York, produced Medea, John Gielgud in Importance of Being Earnest, and teamed up with Tyrone Guthrie to start the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis. You know, I almost strangled him to death in a play. He saw me coming, and he realized that the emotions were working in me like, this is my chance to be a star. And he saw me coming, and he's thinking to himself, here comes Holbrook. He's gone crazy now. He's going to kill me. And I got my hands around his throat. And I was squeezing and squeezing. I was playing a maniac. And finally he said on the stage, he goes, Holbrook, it's only a play. And we had a number of other people. Perry Fisk was a good friend of mine. Became an actor. As a matter of fact, he was assistant stage manager also when Paul Muni did Inherit the Wind. Mm-hmm. And Paul Muni had been a hero of mine. And Perry sneaked me into the rehearsal to the back of the theater. And I sat up in the second balcony way back in the dark so nobody would see me. And I watched Paul Muni rehearsing. And it was a great thrill, you know.
Who is this book for?
Hmm?
Who is the book for? I mean, as you were writing, did you think about your children or your grandchildren, or did you think about the people who have watched you on stage and in your films?
This first book was for this little boy on the cover.
You?
Yeah. This little boy that was me. That's what the first book is about. The second book may end up being for Dixie or for my children. I don't know. Dixie was a great influence in my life. But this first book, when I look at that picture, I picked that picture. That picture on the cover of the book of that little boy at 10 years old with a tie and a suit and his hair going off in one direction. Is smiling. And that picture my wife Dixie put under a lamp that I turn off in the living room every night. I still turn it off, even though she's gone. And I look at that picture and I used to look at it and I think, that little boy is me. Why is he smiling? I knew that at that time he was getting beaten by that really weird headmaster, mm-hmm, in that New England school who loved to beat kids and never tell you why with a stick, you know, till you cried. I knew he didn't have any parents. Why is he smiling? And so one night I went and got a legal pad and I started writing a book. I started out, the original beginning was, my name is Harold. When I was 7 years old, they sent me away to make a man of me. That's what they did in New England, you know. And my editor changed it around and started with my mother.
Mm-hmm.
He said, Hal, we want to know who you are before we have you get beaten by this headmaster. We want to know who the little boy is. So he started with my mother, and he was right. But anyway, I look at that picture, and I think to myself now, Harold, I finally told your story, because why is he smiling? You know, he's smiling, but you can see the impishness in his eyes, but there's something about the smile that's not total. It's like he's looking things over. He's checking things out at the same time, and that's that was apparently what I was doing. And, you know, as I said, I think earlier, you know, writing an autobiographical book, why do you do it? You end up doing it. If you don't know when you start, you end up doing it to find out who in hell you are. Who am I? Who was I? What started me going? Why did I do these things? Why did I do these things? Some things that I'm so ashamed of, I don't want to. What made me do that? Why? That's why you write a book. And I finally figured out that little boy was just not going to give up. He did not know how to quit.
You talk throughout the book at different times, and sometimes it's more like adventure, and other times it sounds really dark and frightening, about this suicide impulse that you had.
Mm-hmm.
Has that gone away?
No. I carry it on stage with me. I take chances on stage that a lot of actors wouldn't take. And also I have done things like, you know, in this book, I talk about climbing that mountain.
Mount Shasta. Mm-hmm.
Trying to, you know, 4 days in the wilderness with nobody around at all up there on the edge of a glacier. And I didn't even know how to get the fire starting. I was frightened to death of bears. I was sure that a bear, and one night, you know, when I was in the cabin, I heard a bear pushing against the side of the cabin, you know, and in the morning, I got to see the big imprints in the snow. It snowed like heck that night. But, you know, later on, I sailed alone across the ocean. I sailed alone across the ocean, 2,400 miles alone, with a compass and a sextant. I had no long-distance radio. I had no electronics, nothing. And by the time I got over toward Hawaii and was looking for the island of Kauai, in the north shore of it, to come in, it was in a single-handed race, 1980, I couldn't get a sextant shot because the cloud cover was so much. I had to navigate on the null of a small portable radio about 6 inches wide. I had to navigate, find the null in Hilo, in the Big Island, and Oahu, and then the null on Nawili Willi on Kauai and Oahu. And the null gives you about a 15-degree accuracy. So you could be 15 degrees when, you know, somewhere in 15 degrees. So that's all. And as you get closer to the null, it gets wider, and it's no good. And I went across the Kauai Channel at the end of that voyage, and the radio, you know, the weather said we had 45 knot winds in the Kauai Channel with 20-foot seas. I mean, I was standing in the cockpit with water up to my knees sometimes when waves came in. And I was exhausted. I hadn't slept for at least a day and a half. And I wasn't sure where I was.
So is taking that kind of a risk almost a reminder that you don't want to die?
I don't want to die. I'm damn sure I'm not going to. I'm going to do whatever I can not to. But I don't know what it is. I don't know. It's like I haven't been able to resist a challenge, you know? I never thought of that while I was growing up. I didn't think, I don't resist a challenge. I never thought about that at all. I was frightened to death of most. I was frightened all the time. Frightened of people, frightened of this, that, and the other thing. But I took chances. And it became a way of life to me. Why? I don't know.
Is that yearning for adventure part of what explains your connection to Into the Wild and the entire sort of arc of the story that film told?
Oh, yeah. I had a very strong connection to that. Also, my son David, I was not a good father because I was too busy all the time. I was on the road. More than half of my life, I was on the road. I was not a good father because, in the sense that, I mean, I wasn't cruel or anything, but what I did was cruel because I didn't spend time with them. I just had no time for my children, my two younger children anyway. I improved a great deal with my third child, Eve, and my stepchildren. I had Dixie too. Be their mother, and that made all the difference in the world, all the difference in the world, because she was absolutely marvelous. But I was not a good father. I didn't pay attention to my children. I had no time. I was too motivated to. Yeah, I've been trying to assess this because the second book is really, I get into it. Some of the things I have to tell about in the second book, I was really ashamed of. And the only reason I talk about it is because I know there are people out there who are going through the same experience in one way or another. I mean, nobody's perfect. We shouldn't be ashamed to admit our faults. And that is the big thing in this second book. I got to it in the Herald. I am not afraid to admit my faults. I have many faults. Why not admit them? Because you have to face them in your mind. You have to face them in the darkness of your own soul. Why not face them in the light? It's scarier, but it's the only way to live, I think, and to if you want to improve yourself somehow. I've tried to improve myself as a father. I've wounded my two older children severely. They love me in their way. But I live with the conviction that even though you're forgiven, the damage you did is there.
So do you forgive yourself?
Hmm?
Do you forgive yourself?
Myself?
Yeah.
Yes, the damage that I did is done. It cannot be changed. You can only try to improve. You can only try to correct it, to help it, to try to improve. And my wife, Dixie, was a beautiful soul. She had a true moral sense and a foundation. She believed in right and wrong. She was a very religious person. Unlike me, I always questioned religion because I questioned the way man uses religion to make himself feel okay. I mean, beginning with the idea that you go and lynch a black man on Saturday night and go to church on Sunday and call yourself a Christian. The whole idea of that just made no sense to me. It was disgusting. So I had trouble with religion. But Dixie, so I started going to church because I want to be with Dixie on Sunday. Now that she's gone, I go to church. When I'm home and I take one of my daughters with Dixie, whom I've been with my two stepdaughters since they were 10 and 11, so I'm very, very close to them, and we go to church. She had a moral sense. She was brought up in a little two-gas pump, one-cannon town in Tennessee by a mother and a daddy who treated her and her sister and her brother beautifully. They were given a belief in themselves, in their worth. They were given just everything they wanted and needed. And so Dixie Carter could walk in to a palace and feel at home. Absolutely feel at home. Not if she was intimidated, you'd never know it.
Hal Holbrook, thank you so much for spending this hour with us. I really had a great time. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Hal Holbrook's new memoir is called Harold, The Boy Who Became Mark Twain. My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.